Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Of the thousands of people I have interviewed on this show over the years, I would have to say my guest today might have the most singular resume. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. As a kid, Isaac Lidsky starred in Saved by the Bell, The New Class, playing the character best described as the new Screech. Then he went to Harvard, where he finished his undergraduate degree at 19 and on to Harvard Law and to clerking for Supreme Court Justices Sandra Day O'Connor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. He served on the appellate staff of the Civil Division at the Department of Justice, then worked in a private tax practice before shifting gears entirely to buy a failing construction company and turn it into a $150 million business. He also founded a nonprofit with the goal of raising $20 million for medical research. He's raising four kids, including triplets. He also happens to be blind. He had lost all sight by the time he was 25. But as he'll tell us, Lidsky says his disability gave him far more than it took away. Isaac Lidsky's new book is called Eyes Wide Open, Overcoming Obstacles and Recognizing Opportunities that the World Can't See Clearly. He joins us this hour from the studios of WMFE in Orlando, Florida. Isaac, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
You open the book with an epigraph by Helen Keller that says, "Worse than being blind is having sight but no vision." You say you've gained vision by losing your sight.
Absolutely. So, you know, when I was first diagnosed with my blinding disease, I knew that blindness was going to ruin my life. It's not something I thought. I knew it. I had this sort of awful vision of my future, and I thought it was the end of achievement and a dependence for me, and on and on and on. In a remarkable way, in a beautiful way, really, the disease was kind of part of the cure. I literally saw the immense power of the mind to shape and sort of ultimately create and control the reality we experience. So the way I lost my sight sort of slowly over time produced all these bizarre effects. And like I said, it really wound up being a very empowering and liberating experience for me.
For one thing, you realized if your eyes could effectively play tricks on you, your brain could too, that your perceptions of things weren't necessarily objective truth.
Yes, that's exactly right. So, you know, we have this this experience of sight. I certainly did before I started losing mine. You open your eyes, there's the world. You know, we say seeing is believing, and it feels sort of immersive and passive, and like sort of what's out there is objective and true. I saw that, the truth is extremely different. Sight is this just masterful illusion that we create for ourselves in our minds. And it implicates far more than just information from the eyes. But it's ultimately the result of, you know, sort of this predictive engine. You know, the brain is this sort of, really breathtaking predictive engine that sort of tries to infer and assume and kind of reason from past experiences. But again, what struck me was how profoundly different the sort of feeling of the experience is from sort of the truth of it. And as you said, I realized that there's all sorts of ways in our lives that we unknowingly experience a sort of immutable and objective truth, things that are really, you know, sort of machinations of our own mind and that we can control if we are aware and accountable.
Do you still think in visual images?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm a very visual person. The visual cortex is active in far more than just sight. When you're dreaming, when you're recalling memories, when you're conceptualizing things, and I'm a very visual person.
All right, I want to start go back to your early background. You briefly became a celebrity at a very tender age, which could be like both the best and worst thing to happen to somebody. For you, I guess it was neither.
I would definitely go with neither. So I grew up acting in Miami, Florida, my hometown, and probably did somewhere between 100 and 150 commercials growing up. Got some, you know, big breaks in small things and small parts in big things, and then, you know, ultimately this sort of life-changing role of Weasel Wiesel on Saved by the Bell, The New Class, and moved out to LA. It was an amazing experience. It was very interesting. I'm very grateful that I had that sort of Hollywood fairy tale kind of experience, but you know, I was cast on the show when I was 13, right around the same time that I was diagnosed with my blinding disease. So that definitely sort of impacted my perspective on the business and the career and kind of what I wanted to do with my life.
You also got this sense of what it meant to be famous for nothing. Like all the publicity machine was in place before the show had even aired.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the original show was wildly popular. By the time, you know, NBC was casting the new class with the sort of vacated Saturday morning time slot, the Entertainment Tonight covered the search for the new class, and they did a sort of nationwide search, and it was all this attention. So that literally within about 10-15 minutes of learning that I had scored the role along with my colleagues on the show, we were escorted into a big kind of amphitheater in at NBC Studios in Burbank, and we held a press conference with something like 250 media outlets. It was essentially sort of instantaneous.
Hmm. And then it sort of went away as quickly as it had come for you.
Right. Yeah. So I did I was on the new class for a season, and I was planning to leave Los Angeles sort of by the end of it. And a year later, after my junior year of high school, I went off to college, and it just all sort of kind of trickled away.
Okay. You say junior year in high school. You said you started the show when you were 13. You went through school very quickly. I wonder, did your diagnosis give you a sense that there was sort of an expiration date on your vision and therefore you had to finish your education?
Absolutely. So, beyond education, I mentioned this sort of awful and baseless kind of a scenario, that my fears sort of filled in about sort of going blind and being blind. I thought I was kind of in a race against time until, the curtains fell, so to speak. And I was eager to squeeze as much as I could into my life, before blindness ruined it. I wound up applying to college my junior year of high school. I had already skipped a grade or two along the way. And so a couple weeks after I turned 16, I started college and graduated when I was 19 and on and on.
You write that going blind was far harder than being blind.
Absolutely. And there's no doubt about that. I mean, in retrospect, I'm really glad. I think it was a gift that I had this sort of slow and sort of bizarre experience losing my sight, because it gave me the sort of eyes wide open insight that has brought me immeasurable joy and fulfillment in my life. That said, the challenges of a degenerative condition, of a progressive condition, I mean, it's tough. I was constantly kind of in this world of how much worse is it going to get and how quickly, and this kind of a sort of bargain with God or some higher power of, man, if it would just stay the way it is today, I can handle it. But, but what's tomorrow going to look like? And this sort of, like I said, for, a dozen years, the sort of anticipation of blindness was far worse than blindness has turned out to be in my life.
It's really interesting because people that I have known who have significant disabilities, they tend to manage quite well. And this is not to minimize the things that are more challenging if your body doesn't work like everyone else's does. But it's like the rest of the world that is able-bodied is somehow not able to have a realistic picture of what it would be like to have to do without a particular ability.
Yeah, so we fear the unknown. And so much of disability or the challenges that sort of others face is for us, scary because it's unknown. We don't have any basis of experience to draw upon. I certainly, made all sorts of assumptions about blindness and being blind. And looking back, I'm horrified at what I thought. And it was just because I allowed sort of the void of the unknown to be filled by my fears, by this sort of awfulizing, which is a word psychologists use, which I absolutely love. But all of us, I should say, I think in some sense, we're all disabled. We all face challenges. We all impose disabilities upon ourselves. I think this notion that there's a sort of us or them is a fallacy.
One of the things you've discovered that I guess is not going away is that for some people, when they first meet you, you have to deal with the fact that they are somehow made uncomfortable by your blindness.
Yes, absolutely. It is as something that sort of consistently ranked toward the top of the things people fear, right? Blindness. It's something that not always, but often makes people uncomfortable and anxious. And one of the tricky things about human emotion and human connection is, you know, those feelings can be, you know, infectious.
Mm-hmm.
So it took me some time, a good deal of time and effort and thought, to really work on understanding, appreciating that, you know, the circumstances out there, others' anxiety is not, you know, something that's within my control, certainly not fully within my control. But how I respond to it, how that circumstance sort of manifests itself in my life is entirely within my control. So, you know, I am not awkward or anxious about my blindness. It's something that I'm perfectly comfortable with.
As you began to lose more useful vision, you struggled with accepting the outward symbols of blindness. You didn't want to use a cane. I gather you didn't wear glasses, dark glasses. Talk about why you resisted for so long and what changed when you realized these things were just tools.
Sure. So I think there's kind of two parts to it. The first is just, you know, our sort of misconception of strength and weakness and sort of vulnerability and confidence and all that. And I had all these, you know, frankly, you know, sort of false ideas about what vulnerability meant and what needing help meant. And sort of the cane certainly is a very visible signal that, you know, that I'm challenged, that, you know, that I'm flawed in some ways. So that was a big part of it. Relatedly, you know, is kind of denial. You know, I think early on in my sort of journey into blindness, I was really singularly focused on the idea of a cure and science and these sort of brilliant researchers who were working so hard to save me. And I was a sort of a proud and energetic supporter of their research and their efforts. And I thought it was, you know, acceptance and sort of a bold, you know, productive way to handle my diagnosis, my disease. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think it really was also in large part, you know, a denial, a failure to come to terms with what I needed to do to make my life easier and better and sort of to create the life I wanted for myself.
Looking back, do you feel like that denial, that despair was a necessary part of the journey, even if it's one that you're glad that you've moved on from?
That's interesting. I don't think so. I mean, you know, I certainly, I don't think so. So, you know, the reason why I love sort of talking about this sort of eyes wide open vision of mine and why I wrote about it and all that is I don't think it's about blindness or disability or even necessarily sort of overcoming challenges. You know, for me, I feel I got this this amazing view into the sort of the power of the mind, this sort of ability that we have in every moment to sort of choose who we want to be and how we want to live our lives. And I certainly think that if we can properly understand that power, embrace it, learn to kind of work with it, you know, my strong hope would be we can skip over things like denial and the, you know, the sort of more challenging and sort of less productive ways that we tend to deal with things in our lives.
My guest is entrepreneur Isaac Lidsky. He lost his sight to retinitis pigmentosa, acted as a Supreme Court law clerk, was a former child actor, now runs a large construction services company. He's also author of a new book called Eyes Wide Open, Overcoming Obstacles and Recognizing Opportunities That the World Can't See Clearly. We will be back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Isaac Lidsky. He runs a large construction services company. He's a former Supreme Court law clerk and child actor. He is also blind. His new book is called Eyes Wide Open, Overcoming Obstacles and Recognizing Opportunities That the World Can't See Clearly. Isaac, I want to talk about the critic and the strong man, which are two sort of characters that you imagine we all carry with us. How do they weigh in on the choices we make, on the things we do, on the ways that we perform in our world?
Sure. So, you know, the emotions we feel, the things we think about ourselves, the emotions we confront in sort of tough times in our lives can often distort our reality, can kind of really be pernicious. So, you know, the critic is this nasty voice that we have. We all harbor an internal critic. And, you know, the critic's quick to pass judgment, to tell us what we can't do, to tell us what others will think about us. And, you know, the critic presents this sort of lofty, idealized view soaring high above it all, and you know, the paths of progress are too small to see, the rate of progress looks too slow, and you know, we're just overwhelmed by the sort of the magnitude of our aspirations. And when you get sort of sucked into that view of the critic within, you know, it can be overwhelming, and often we tell ourselves it's not worth the effort. We tell ourselves, you know, we're doing the mature thing, the sensible thing, carry on. And meanwhile, you know, we're thwarted from pursuing that which is important to us or exciting to us.
You've had to learn, or you have chosen to be a risk taker. It is a significant risk to leave a well-paid corporate law practice and go into business for yourself.
Yes. Yeah, so a big part of this eyes wide open vision or philosophy that I try to live up to every day is really being aware of what success looks like for yourself, what value looks like, what's important to you, how do you want to be spending your time, you know, in at home, at work, in your relationship. So after a you know, 8-year sort of legal joyride doing things that I loved in law, I wound up practicing for a large international law firm and was pretty unhappy in my career. Now, to be clear, plenty of people you know, are meant to be big law firm litigators, enjoy it, find meaning in it, and that's fine. The problem is I wasn't such a person. So, you know, really putting my money where my mouth is and sort of holding myself accountable, I said, you got to do something about it. So I kind of ditched the legal career and with my college roommate bought a struggling residential construction subcontractor in Orlando, Florida, moving my family, my wife, and my then infant triplets from Manhattan to Orlando to take over as the first chief executive officer of our new business. And so I'm glad I did it, but you know, as I recount, it was you know, not a move without its challenges. We had some real hard times early on.
Well, you describe it as struggling, and I have earlier in the show. You didn't realize quite how struggling it was until you got in and owned the business.
That's right. So we thought we were buying a company that was kind of treading water. We knew it wasn't setting any records for success, but we thought it was kind of getting by. And we were super excited about the team we would inherit. We were excited about our vision for building something excellent and sort of how we could sort of evolve the value proposition in our market and all those things. Come to pass, about 3 months in, we realized pretty dramatically that far from treading water, this business was sinking like a stone. It's literally hemorrhaging money. And all the data we had meticulously analyzed, you know, here a Harvard lawyer and a Harvard sort of finance guy, my college roommate, you know, we poured over all this information that turned out to be nonsense, you know, just garbage in, garbage out. I don't think anybody really had any idea what was going on with the business when we showed up. So that was a tough time, a real tough time in my life. And yeah, I'm blessed to work with a great team and we turned it around, but not without our challenges.
And again, you had this decision like, okay, do I just, you know, cut my losses at this point or do I really double down? You borrowed money from your mom.
Yeah. In the midst of all this, I kind of confessed my, you know, the epic error of my entrepreneurial escapade to my mom. And she shared with me that sort of unbeknownst to me or anyone really in my family of origin, she had been squirreling away money over the years, literally cash, hard currency. A Cuban immigrant herself, the daughter of a man who had to start over from scratch in his life several times. The way she was raised, governments come and go, banks come and go, so you save hard cash. So anyway, she lets on that she has $350,000 in cash squirreled away, and without the slightest hesitation, offers it up to me and says she's convinced that I can fix this, can save this dying business. That led to a really difficult decision to make, which I wrestled with for a few days. Ultimately, this is the whole critic and the strong man. Our challenge in the face of our sort of fear of failure and in the face of ongoing struggle, our challenge is to silence that internal critic within and to harness our internal strength, to listen to our inner strong man.
Now that you've paid her back, have you talked her into keeping her money in something other than hard currency, like stashed under the bed or somewhere?
Yeah, so I did tell her, when I paid her back, Mom, I'm going to have to give you a check. I'm sorry. I'm not going to return it in cash. So.
All right, well, let's talk about those babies. Like a lot of young couples, you and your wife were delighted to discover she was pregnant. This was no ordinary pregnancy.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, we decided we were officially ready and, took necessary measures to, start our family. We were pretty sure we were going to have a child. Dorothy, became pregnant. We went to get an early pregnancy scan. We were living in London at the time. Wanted to ensure that the heart of our child was healthy and growing. And we were informed that it was not one or two, but three babies. She had conceived triplets, naturally conceived triplets. So that was quite a bit of information to get, and it obviously changed the course of our lives in ways we never would have imagined, but ultimately in beautiful ways. We were very blessed.
It's, of course, not the same thing as learning that you will, progressively lose your sight, but it is the kind of thing that people hear, and they first their minds go to all the challenges of having three children simultaneously.
Yes, and what I didn't realize at sort of the moment of realization was how difficult the pregnancy would be, mm-hmm. and the extent to which it would carry, risks for Dorothy and for our children that were not just, greater than the average risks of a singleton, but like actually substantial risks in absolute measure. So it was a really challenging pregnancy for Dorothy, and obviously I was right there with her, and then our children were born, as triplets tend to be, born premature and low birth weight and all that. So all in, my family spent just shy of 100 days living out of the hospital, Cornell Hospital on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. And it was a difficult time, but one that ultimately, proved miraculous. My family really, defied the odds over and over again, and we have these three beautiful, wonderful, phenomenal children we adore. And now they have a baby sister, 15-month-old baby Clementine. So,
is one baby just a breeze after you had triplets, preemie triplets?
The answer is yes. I mean, there's no easy configuration of children, and I would imagine that if Dorothy and I had just had a singleton, we would have been exhausted and all stuff and whatever. That said, Clementine is just, we call her tag along. She just kind of comes right along with us, and it's super easy and a joy. But I joke, at the same time, it's interesting because really it was a very intense experience. The pregnancy, the time they spent in the neonatal intensive care unit, even when we brought them home, and it was intense and difficult. It's nice for Dorothy and me to now have sort of more of a easier or sort of purely joyful, less stressful kind of experience with our baby girl, which on top of it all, we get to share it with the Tripskys.
That's what you call them. The Lidsky triplets are the Tripskys.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So the triplets are the Tripskys. And then all together, the four of them are the Kidskys.
I wonder if your experience with the triplets and the little one that the doctors called Baby C before delivery had real significant problems, apparent problems. there's this sense as a parent that you're supposed to control everything, and then there's this creeping realization that you control very little.
Yes, and for us, that's the sort of the journey into that sort of a understanding that we are not in control, we will never be in control. That kind of began when we found out it was triplets, right? Here, Dorothy and I had spent countless hours debating whether we were going to have a second child or not. We had my career planned out, her career planned out, and all these designs. Meanwhile, she was carrying triplets. So, yes, the that feeling of not being in control really only intensified for us throughout her pregnancy, as you said. There were some great challenges that baby C faced, and some of the doctors not so subtly encouraged us to reduce or eliminate baby C, which, it's fine by way of medical advice. That's fine. And we certainly wouldn't judge folks who make that decision. It's a decision for the parents to make. But for us, we struggled with a little bit of the sort of judgment, I guess you could call it, that maybe we were being reckless or irrational. We ultimately, decided that we would, God gave us these three and we'd fight for them indivisibly and without limitation. And that was a decision that was the source of a lot of agony and doubt and guilt along the way. But ultimately, we were convinced that it was the right decision for us, and it was a decision that was blessedly vindicated.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Isaac Lidsky. We're talking to him about his new book, Eyes Wide Open, Overcoming Obstacles and Recognizing Opportunities That the World Can't See Clearly. After the triplets were born, Isaac, you realized you could probably, as a man without sight, could get away with not changing diapers. Why in the world was it so important to you to participate in caring for your kids in this way?
So, we all make these sort of self-limiting assumptions about ourselves and kind of give into maybe the sort of weaknesses or challenges that others perceive in us. And if we're not careful, it can all kind of mush together in our minds and kind of threaten our conception of who we are. When we brought those triplets home, as you said, being a blind guy, first of all, just being a guy and then being blind on top of it all, I could have begged off the diaper duty and the bottle duty and all that. And I'm sure Dorothy would have relented. But, when we kind of perpetuate, give into these sort of self-limiting assumptions, when we, aren't vigilant, don't keep a vigilant watch on the ways we're looking at ourselves, those seeds grow and, get worse, and it's pernicious. So for me, it was a real simple analysis. I said, do you think you can figure out a solution, a way to change diapers and feed the babies? Absolutely. Of course I can. Is it important to me to participate as a father, in those in that part of rearing my children? Yes, it's important to me. So, answering those two questions that way really left me no choice as far as I saw it. So I definitely changed many, many diapers and fed my tiny babies a lot of very tiny bottles.
So to your kids, you're just daddy. You've always been there and they know you as you and see you as 100% the most important man in their lives. I wonder, though, how they came to understand this thing that they could do, this sense that they had command of that you don't have.
Children are just remarkable, right? Miraculous, beautiful, all the above. For my kids, as they sort of, grew from infants to toddlers and, now 6.5 years old, it's just the most natural thing in the world. They've never known any different, right? And along the way, Dorothy saying to my kids, hey, go show daddy something. It just, they intuited, it became natural to them that go show daddy means put it in his hands. Sit on his lap and put it in his hands and then maybe describe it to me as well. So it's something obviously, well, not obviously, but it's something that I worried about. I was concerned about. Are my children going to be limited in some way given my blindness, or is it something that they're going to struggle with? At the end of the day, it's supernatural for them, and I'd like to believe it's made them a little more aware or more sensitive to the ways different people relate to the world. Certainly they are growing up without any of the sort of assumptions or sort of faulty logic that I grew up with unknowingly about the blind and the disabled.
You tell a great story of, the point at which you had sort of accepted the way that you moved through the world and realized that you were developing other strategies for getting around. You went to a restaurant with your wife and another couple. Can you tell that story?
Sure. So I, was already using a cane. I had very little useful sight, pretty much no useful sight to speak of at this time. And, I had been really working hard to integrate, new tools and systems and techniques to get around. We went to a new restaurant none of us had ever been to. We were made to wait a little bit, even though we had a reservation, which is a pet peeve of mine. But eventually we were shown to the table, and the woman from the other couple that was joining us for dinner, said, "Hey, does anyone know where the restroom is? I got to go to the restroom." And Dorothy chimed in and said, "Yeah, I bet it's over there in that sort of far corner." Visually, that kind of seemed like where it should be. And really, without even realizing I was doing it, I spoke up and said, no. Remember when we about halfway down the bar, we made that right turn, we walked down that sort of narrow hallway and then made another right turn. If instead of making that right, you had made a left and gone down the stairs, that's where the bathrooms are. At which point, pretty much everybody was thinking the same thing, which is like, what the heck is Isaac talking about? Like, what is he saying? And even if I thought the same, I was like, what am I saying? But it struck me, that was really the first time that it hit me, that this what had begun as a real sort of conscious, difficult, effort I had to make to glean information using my other senses and to sort of aggregate that information and draw logical inferences and all that kind of stuff. Again, we're so infinitely adaptable as the human organisms with this brain we have. It had become totally natural. It happened sort of without effort or conscious thought.
My guest is Isaac Lidsky. We're talking about his book, Eyes Wide Open, Overcoming Obstacles and Recognizing Opportunities That the World Can't See Clearly. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Isaac Lidsky. He is an entrepreneur, a former child actor, and Supreme Court law clerk. He runs a large construction services company, and he is blind. He lost his sight at 25 to retinitis pigmentosa, a progressive hereditary disease. His new book is called Eyes Wide Open, Overcoming Obstacles and Recognizing Opportunities That the World Can't See Clearly. Isaac, you have embraced your inner strong man, but sometimes you realize you have to educate other people. It has been a theme at different times in your careers that people have underestimated you, sometimes because of an honest mistake and sometimes because they were just being ignorant. The one time that it really hurt you was when your boss, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, appeared to have assumed that you couldn't take care of yourself. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Thanks. Yeah, that was a really interesting experience for me. I was traveling with the justice in Philadelphia, and she was sitting by designation on a lower court of appeal, Third Circuit Court of Appeal. I was traveling with her, helping her with her work, and she gave a bunch of speeches and all this. And she had this huge motorcade, and she has literally infinite amount of energy and, less than half her age, but I was exhausted and drained and very much looking forward to kind of getting away. But she caught wind of my plans to meet up with a friend at a cigar bar and insisted on taking me there in this 7-car motorcade. and sort of along the way, I began to, she's notorious for being super protective and caring, you know, in particular, super protective of her law clerks. And I knew that. It kind of goes without saying, but along the way, I was kind of wondering, is this different? Is it just because I'm blind? Does she think that that I'm incapable of getting her on my own? Just kind of just how much help does she think I require? You know, as it turned out, her concern, her insistence that she take me to the cigar bar really had to do with the fact that they had received a threat that, you know, wasn't too credible or too serious, but certainly warranted taking additional safety precautions. And unbeknownst to me, the justice she kind of didn't want to worry me, but she did want to make sure that I was taken care of and protected. And so here I was making assumptions about the way she was viewing me, when in reality, you know, nothing of the sort was going on. And it's an important story in my life, because this time around, I kind of, you know, the sort of the misconception was revealed, was exposed. But it happens all the time in our lives that it's not, right? We think we understand what's going on in others' minds and hearts. We think we can see ourselves through the eyes of others. And in reality, we just can't. You know, we're worlds unto ourselves. So, you know, that experience really emphasized for me, reminded me how important it is to live with sort of awareness of and accountability for, you know, the perceptions we make about ourselves, the perceptions we, you know, foist upon others about ourselves.
For people who may be wondering how you are able to finish school, act as a Supreme Court law clerk, run a corporation, can you talk about some of the adaptive technologies that have really kind of empowered you to do what you need to get done?
Sure. So screen reading software, I would put at the top of that list. This is software that enables me to interact with my computer using my ears instead of my eyes. I basically listen to everything. It narrates menus and options and all that kind of stuff. So there's a program called JAWS, which I use on the PC. Apple has something called VoiceOver, which is similar. And these are great programs. I mean, people are often surprised to learn that I can pretty much do anything I need to do on my smartphone or computer or otherwise. And so there's other sort of gadgets or systems or techniques. But, you know, bigger picture, you know, I guess the point is that problems, when we view problems, when we break them down into their sort of most discrete, specific form, when we tackle the kind of a bite-sized piece of what's an actual and immediate challenge today, right now in front of us, there's always solutions. There are always solutions. Practical solutions for practical problems. So, you know, for me, it was such an interesting shift in my perspective. Blindness is this sort of awful fate, this amorphous boogeyman, the kind of doom and gloom, the end of my life. Shifting to blindness is a series of practical challenges that I am entirely capable of and responsible to, you know, develop practical solutions for those problems. And the same is true for everyone in life. You know, we all confront our challenges, our difficult circumstances, aspects of our lives that we regret. And it's, you know, we're empowered to find solutions.
By the way, you are a relatively rapid speaker, and some of that I attribute to living on the East Coast and sort of having that lifestyle. But when you listen to things on your computer, when you are reviewing documents that are translated for you into spoken speech, you listen to them at this breakneck speed.
Yes, I do. So this is yet another one of a countless ways that, you know, I got to experience my mind kind of adapting and evolving to the challenge of blindness. So the average American speaker in the U.S., the average English speaker in the U.S. Speaks, I think, about 150 words a minute. The average person reads, I think it's somewhere around 300 words a minute, although obviously there are people who can read a lot faster. I've, over time, developed the ability to listen to somewhere around 700 to 725 words a minute. I now can listen to documents, books, you know, the newspaper, et cetera, far faster than I ever could read when I had, you know, quote unquote, normal sight. So it's a neat thing.
Are you better at keeping yourself from getting distracted than the average person? You must be.
Well, I would think so, to the extent that, you know, I don't have that sort of torrent of visual information that's sort of constantly bombarding the sighted world. We are inherently visual creatures. A full third of our brain by volume is devoted to processing information from the eyes, although it's linked to all sorts of other parts of the brain, too. And in any second, the enterprise of sight can claim as much as two-thirds of your brain's computational resources. So we're definitely designed to favor sight. When you take that away, you've got a lot of free computing cycles that I put to use in other endeavors.
What is your relationship to luck?
What my relationship? So there's obviously we all confront circumstances in our life that are out of our control, that are, you know, random acts of chance or luck is a force in everyone's lives. I think that we tend to sort of grossly oversimplify luck, that we misperceive luck in at least a couple ways. First is we tend to have this idea that events are good or bad, or, you know, lucky or unlucky in absolute terms, and that there's some neat and tidy distinction to be drawn. In my experience, the truth is a lot more nuanced and complex. I mean, circumstances are. What we make of them is up to us. I mean, blindness, for example, I know to my core, I am certain that going blind, the way in which I went blind, turned out to be, you know, a blessing for me. I was lucky to go blind because it gave me this insight. Another way that we misperceive luck, I feel, is that we tend to think, you know, again, there's a tidy dividing line between circumstances that are within our control and those that are not within our control. When, you know, again, I'd say the truth is a lot more nuanced and complicated. Often we have a lot more control over matters than we think.
You say that it's as important to learn to recover from big wins as big losses. And I think this is a really interesting way of thinking about things.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, so that's in the chapter. That's in a part of the book where I'm trying to draw parallels between the game of poker.
Right.
And life, to kind of illustrate my thinking about luck, the eyes wide open view of luck. So in poker, as in life, you know, you have a monster win, and there's this this feeling, this impulse to you know, become convinced that you're unbeatable, that you're on a winning streak, that, you know, the luck is with you, fate is with you. And in poker, as in life, you might then you know, lose discipline in your strategy and in the quality of your play, lose focus on what's in, you know, in life, I would say lose focus on what's important to you, lose focus on the sort of centrality of the effort of the actual striving in life as opposed to the outcome. And your big wins can be more harmful than your losses.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Isaac Lidsky. We're talking to him about his new book, Eyes Wide Open, Overcoming Obstacles and Recognizing Opportunities That the World Can't See Clearly. You make a note of the fact that when you are communicating, obviously with anyone in your life, but with people that you don't necessarily know very well personally, business associates, you can't see their faces. And so you want to be particularly clear that you're understanding what they're trying to say to you. Can you talk a little bit about how you do that?
Sure. So yeah, I lose facial expressions and gestures, as you noted, which, you know, it's interesting because I think often we place way too much value on sort of facial expressions and gestures. And whereas I do think it's important for, you know, if you're lucky to have sight and you can see someone and their facial expressions or gestures that are maybe inconsistent with your understanding of what they're trying to communicate to you, it's important to pay attention to that. But I argue that it's important to pay attention only insofar as it's sort of a sign of a need for better verbal communication. It's a need to sort of to obtain greater clarity, because I think we do ourselves a real disservice when we think that we understand what's going on in someone else's mind or heart or soul. Based on their facial expressions or their gestures. And we, again, we're designed, our brain is sort of literally wired to predict, infer, assume, you know, to think that we've got all the angles, we know all the answers. And so, you know, you see a facial expression, you see someone make a gesture, And without even knowing it, you know, you can make all sorts of assumptions about what's going on for that person in their world. And in my experience, you know, at least, that those assumptions are very rarely, if ever, correct or accurate. Certainly not comprehensive.
What have you learned about the value of communicating like a five-year-old?
So we, you know, we are in sort of protecting ourselves, guarding ourselves from, you know, wanting to protect our image and wanting others to think well of us and at work and at home and in relationships. You know, we tend to really obscure the meaning of what we're trying to say in all sorts of ways. And we tend to talk like lawyers, I think, really advancing a position or an agenda or a motive more than trying to convey meaning. What's remarkable to me, having, you know, now 3 6.5-year-olds, but, you know, at one point I'm having had 3 5-year-olds, the Shripskys, 5-year-olds don't do that. They will tell you what they mean and what they think and what they feel. And if our aim is to be understood and to communicate at a meaningful level, I think that though we tend to speak like lawyers, we should instead aim to speak more like 5-year-olds. So one trick I use a lot when I don't feel like I'm totally getting what someone's trying to say to me, or not even what they're trying to say, the subtext is, you know, I'll say, I'm sorry, but, you know, you got to explain this for me. Yeah, you got to explain this to me like I'm a 5-year-old. Can you break this down for me like I'm a 5-year-old? And of course, you know, what I'm really saying there is, you know, you got to speak like a 5-year-old.
Two of your 3 sisters received the same diagnosis you did on the same day. Have their journeys through sight loss been parallel to yours?
So, no, actually, the oldest of my 3 older sisters, she still has a good deal of useful sight. So it's obviously progressed a lot more slowly for her, you know, on the order of decades more slowly. And like I said, she still has a great deal of useful sight. She can't drive, but she can still read, you know, enlarged text and see faces and that kind of stuff under optimal conditions. The middle one of my 3 older sisters is kind of more in the sort of transition from nuisance to disability. She's kind of losing useful sight these days. But I'm very proud of her and how she's making that transition. But I wound up being the unintentional trailblazer into blindness, I guess. Lost my sight a lot more quickly than my sisters have.
I would imagine they feel fortunate to have you as an example.
I would hope they do.
Isaac Lidsky is a former child actor and Supreme Court law clerk. I still can't get over putting those two things together, who now runs a large construction services company. He founded the nonprofit Hope for Vision. His new book is called Eyes Wide Open, Overcoming Obstacles and Recognizing Opportunities That the World Can't See Clearly. Isaac, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. My personal Twitter handle is at Chris Boyd Think. You can subscribe to the podcast and learn about upcoming shows at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.